Hi, Robin here with Tributaries. It's an interesting path to combine science and spirituality and academia and spirituality, because spirit does not reside in the mind. Yet today's guest, Andrew Vidic, has been performing this balancing act as teacher, student, speaker, and author for many years. Andrew's latest book, Light Upon Light, talks story about five of history's greatest masters and correlates how their lives and ours indeed can lead to light upon light. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome to you, too.
In your email confirming our interview, you said, I look forward to speaking with me. And I actually sat there for a moment or two wondering if it was a lead-in to the One Spirit conversation we would be having, or if it was indeed a Freudian typo.
Well, it was indeed a Freudian typo. However, my own spiritual master, when he had once given a talk in front of a large group of people at the World Fellowship of Religions, he said that, dear brothers and sisters, myself in other forms. So on the deeper level, on the important level, yeah, we're all one.
Right. And yes, and I did want to bring up that one time my friend was writing, just as you said, and instead of writing identification, she wrote identifiction, and it just was glaring at her, and it just sent her off for I don't know how much time, but it definitely brought her into a deeper spot there, too.
Yeah. And for sure, that is such a beautiful way to kind of make a synopsis of this book in many ways. The book is about that great fiction that we think we're the body, we think we're the mind, but and we have forgotten our origin as spirit, as soul, and where we really come from. And in many ways, this book is a book about reminding us about who we are at the deepest levels and bringing us, hopefully, back to that place of centeredness.
Yes. Well, you focus on five masters in Light Upon Light, and I'm wondering if you could share how you came to choose them.
Well, there were several reasons. First, because Rumi and Kabir, to be specific, are themselves going through a kind of renaissance and of reawakening here in the West, particularly Rumi, who recently was described in 2000 by McClure's magazine as the number one best-selling poet alive or dead in the United States. And that renaissance, actually, and that rebirth of his work and his writing has actually become a worldwide phenomena all over the world. In fact, 208 was the actual declared by UNESCO as the Year of Rumi, International Year of Rumi, 207. So the other teacher is Kabir, primarily because in many ways he was the father of Indian spirituality and brought a renaissance of thinking into what real spirituality is, really pulled people back to their source, back to the essence of true spirituality, away from empty rites and rituals, formulas, dogmas, and things that were superficial. And the other three, Nanak, for similar reasons, and I'd say the other reason that moved me is because all of these great saints were also great mystic poets. And I love poetry, and I think that the spirit speaks in the form of poetry, and so their poetry has moved me, and I think it will move other people also. Hafiz, particularly, Hafiz, in many ways, is very much like Rumi because they lived, their lives almost overlapped. They were right in the same area, and Hafiz drew from the writings of Rumi and is really considered in many ways the greatest ghazal poet in the history of the Persian language. So, and his poetry now, like Rumi's, is now beginning to be translated and spread kind of all over the United States as well. And again, it's the timeliness of the message that goes beyond formulaic religions. I think that's what people are resonating with.
It's an evolution to be speaking about spirituality, but there's certainly another giant leap that needs to take place because it's it's almost like, so what? You're talking about higher concepts. And on the same breath, I have to say it is a good evolutionary point to be in.
Yeah, I think that, you know, like, think about, you go back about 30 years and when I started meditating, and very few people were talking about spirituality in the way they are today. Very few people were meditating. Very few people were looking beyond the organized religion. And today, there's no doubt there's a huge revolution going on. I mean, one of the obvious signs of it is you have so many best-selling books that are really spiritually focused. And Eckhart, for example, and another milestone, I think, is the fact that people like Oprah Winfrey,
yes,
are doing webcasts with 1.5 million people on a book like Eckhart Tolle's. And so you have, there's definitely a huge, huge, huge interest. And I've read some Gallup polls that say that many of these people are what we call not particular, they were born into a religion, but they're not particularly strongly aligned with that religion. And that they, and yet, deeply spiritual and having very deep spiritual experiences. But looking for something richer, something deeper, and something that unites and doesn't divide people. Ultimately, I think that's the challenge of religion, is to unite us and not to create barriers between religion and religion.
Yes.
Which has led to so much animosity and hatred.
Right. Well, I think that, well, I know that's something you wanted to do with your book, and you wrote it in a way that you were hoping people would get the essence and use what they could find out about these five masters, and then take that not into a concept, but take that into their own experience and use meditation to create that space for them to have an experience of spirituality. And I would love for you to share maybe some of the contact points, when or where and how one or two of these masters that you wrote about in your book actually made their contact and what it was like for them.
Yeah, and I think you do summarize that. The book tries to take you from the core of their teachings into not just the sense of the path, but actually draw you into the path and allow each of us to begin that journey ourselves. And that's why I put all the very kind of simple exercises at the end of every chapter, so people can actually begin to go into the core of these teachings in a practical sense. The story that I would like to share, which is certainly a powerful and well-known story within the canon of Sufism, the story of Rumi and Shams. Rumi was already a tremendously well-known and powerful figure within the Islamic community in Konya. He had a professorship at the university there, which is a religious professorship, and he had many thousands of disciples, and it is said that on the Friday Jummah prayer, 10,000 people would come to hear him. So he was a well-known, if not extremely important figure at the time. But he had not perfected himself spiritually. He had reputation, he had power, he had many things, but he had not perfected himself. And one day he was discoursing from a very important manuscript by the side of a pool with a group of small disciples. And as he was discoursing, a vagabond-looking figure who would, in everyone's mind, thought to be a poor kind of beggar, approached them. And while he was discoursing, this kind of vagabond beggar asked Rumi, what is this? Meaning, what are you doing? What's the purpose of all of this discourse? And Rumi, sizing him up as a kind of illiterate beggar with little understanding of spiritual matters and little ability to understand, turns to him and gives him a kind of a put down and says, "This, my friend, is the knowledge of which the learned, only the learned can know, or of which the unlearned can know nothing," meaning that he was unlearned and he had no capacity to delve into the depths of this, and put it aside for a second, went back to his discoursing. And Shams, who was actually far more than just a wandering dervish, or a wandering vagabond beggar, he comes up to Rumi and he takes this manuscript and he tosses it unceremoniously into the pond behind him. And, of course, Rumi's disciples and Rumi himself were totally aghast and upset and shocked. and wondered what kind of nonsense that he was doing, throwing away such a valuable manuscript. And as they're shouting and cavorting and getting all upset, Shamsi Tabriz goes over to the pool, puts his hand in the water, and miraculously pulls out the manuscript, and it's completely dry. Not a drop of water on it. And hands it back to Rumi. And, of course, now Rumi is totally out of his element and doesn't know what's going on, looks at Shams and says, what is this? Meaning, what have you done? What is this miracle? What is the meaning of this? And Shams replies back to him in the following words. He says, this, my friends, and he's speaking not just to Rumi, he's talking to the students who are listening. This, my friend, is the knowledge of which the learned, meaning Rumi, can know nothing. This is the knowledge born of ecstasy. This was the knowledge he was giving him an initiation experience. He was saying, "This is you're going in the wrong direction, buddy. You're spending all your time in the mind, getting lost in the folds of the mind and theories and theology and intellectuality. But you have no spiritual power, and you have not connected with that divine within you." And that was his moment of waking. He realized, my God, this is the person I need to follow. This is the person who can take me to a deeper level of spirituality within myself. And that was the beginning of their relationship.
Right. And even though that teacher to Rumi literally pulled the rabbit out of the hat, that is not what true spirituality is. It's not that show. And it was good that he could use that show-off kind of thing to Rumi, because that was the way Rumi was using his spirituality, it sounds like.
But exactly. He was not trying to tell Rumi, okay, let me show you how to do miracles.
Right.
That wasn't the point of it, although people could say, and many people on the path do get tempted by saying, because it seems like, if I could do that, I could get so much power and over people. Of course, that wasn't the message. The message was to demonstrate to him, really, that it's not about the intellect, and that in mysticism, that it's really a journey away from the mind into the heart. And what we mean by the heart is the compassionate heart, the heart of spirituality, the heart of consciousness. And he was really saying to him, listen, if you're interested in this, follow me. If you're interested in knowing what real spirituality is and the depth of it, follow me, because this is where you need to go. And he was contrasting mind with intellect and mind with ecstasy and love. And so the path ultimately for Rumi, as he learned, was really a path of not just unconditional love, but ecstatic love.
Right. And I also think that this time has come as well. So I think you're really leading the pack, so to speak, with this information, because The Secret, I'm sure you're aware of that. Mm. And that was like spiritual hedonism to me, in a sense. It was really putting the focus on the wrong end of things. And there, once again, I think there is a big jump between true mysticism and just coming into the sixth sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so what? I can create all this wealth, you know, and that's and that's great, but keep moving.
Exactly. In fact, I think books like that help pave the way for deeper books like Eckhart Tolle's and that really try to go beyond that superficial kind of materialism. It kind of like, there is a truth in the book which is important for people to understand, and that is that we do, through our thoughts, words, and actions, attract to us through those things to our lives. So if you're resonating with those things and you really want them, there's a saying in mysticism, God gives you whatever you really want. But what do you really want? It's more the question that we have to ask ourselves, not that you have the power to get it, because we do have the power, but it's really not our power, it's God's power that gives it to us.
Exactly.
And the question is, what do you really want? And not, do I want money and power? Because sure, you can have that, but is that going to take you closer to the truth, capital T? And that's what you're saying, and I totally, totally resonate with that. It's an easy temptation in the beginning. And I remember in the 70s and 80s, people were doing all these kind of firewalking, and they were doing you know, spoon mending and all of that. I don't know if you remember all of that.
Of course, yes. I'm just cracking
and that's
up
all,
about it.
That's all part of that empowerment sense of self that, yes, I do have. And it is great to know that. It's great to know that. But it's not the small self. It's the self that's connected to God. It's the selfless self. It's that egoless self that we want to connect to that does everything out of love for others, not out of love for power. And that's the differentiation, which I totally support what you're saying there.
Right. And you have a bit about that in your book where you talk about all of us having a severe case of mistaken identity. I loved how you phrased that.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, I think the fundamental, you know, of spirituality are really simple. They're really simple. It's just that we just don't know who we are. We don't know the greatness of our soul. And the greatness of the soul comes from the greatness of God because the two are connected. And if we can get back to just understanding who we are. And, you know, all traditions really talk about this. You know, the great Greek mystery traditions, man, know thyself, know thee septum. These traditions said, first know yourself. If you know who you are, then knowing your higher power will come naturally. In the Quran, it also says, he who knows himself will know his Lord. So these truths are just really basic stuff that we're kind of reminding ourselves over and over again. We just keep forgetting it all the time. We get caught up and entangled in the myriad kinds of distractions in the world, which lead us to that superficial life that even people who are in it know it's not right. They know they aren't getting anything, but they just don't know the direction to turn yet.
I loved that in your book you were talking about Kabir and how Kabir would use the common language of the day when speaking to the people as opposed to Sanskrit or Arabic, as you put it. And I wasn't aware that Sanskrit was more of a language of the learned people.
Sanskrit...
What language did he use?
Well, actually the common thing was called language called Brogue, which really doesn't exist anymore. And as a result, that that language, it's kind of morphed into various other dialects. But at that time, it was a down-to-earth language that everybody understood. And everybody could, you know, so he was trying to, you have to understand, at that time, both the mullahs, who were the kind of guardians of Islamic knowledge at the time, or you call them the priests, as well as the pundits, who were the kind of guardians of the Hinduism at the time, were talking abstruse doctrines, totally unconnected with practical daily living, and nobody was understanding what they were saying, and they were almost doing it as a way to protect that knowledge so nobody except themselves could have it. And again, so in other words, instead of giving out freely what everybody has a right to, they were using language as a barrier to prevent people from having access to spirituality.
Well, that whole thing, in a sense, is a mystery to me, where they did have, for many, many years, way back when, the mystery schools, and they kept that knowledge secret from the masses, and that's such an interesting control issue that they had.
Totally. And that's the whole thing that Kabir and Nanak, and to a lesser extent, I would say Hafiz and Rumi, because he did write in the Persian language, but that was like the language Francois of the day, but he also spoke Turkish at the time. But the idea is here, you know, get the message out there in a way that people can understand it. And that's why books like, you know, Eckhart Tolle's book or other books that are out there that are selling, if you read it, it's pretty simple English. You know, and there's not a lot of theory and everything. It's meant to be gotten for everybody. It's spirituality should be for everybody. It's not for the academics. And in a sense, that was the difficulty of the time. And I think the revolution was, let's democratize spirituality. Let's make it for everybody. And remember also that Kabir, as well as Nanak, as well as Rumi and Hafiz, were openly critical of the power elite for a variety of reasons, one of which was they were using their position to aggrandize themselves instead of spread spirituality. So they wanted to take it outside religion, outside little boxes, and universalize it. And that's why he's, and that's why the interesting thing about Kabir is that Hindus adore him, Sikhs adore him, the Zoroastrians adore him in India. He's considered the father of one of the great mystics of Sufism. So four or five religions all claim him as their father. And yet, what he says, and if you really follow it, what he's really saying is, listen, I don't belong to any of you. I belong to the one who sent me, which is that universal power.
Yes.
And he just keeps taking it beyond the conventional.
I have to ask you about the Essene language here before we move on. Was that an elitist language? I just don't know.
Well, the Essene language, which the Essene gospel, which is actually one of the more interesting gospels, talks a lot about vegetarianism, and it has a whole different view of Jesus as the Christ than some of the other, some of the other gospels, particularly the canon gospels. And I don't know whether that was an elite language. It was, the Essenes were a small, very spiritually evolved group living in the Dead Sea, and they discovered those Essene scrolls. My scholarship is weak there. I couldn't tell you whether it was an elitist language. It was certainly a very small community, though. This was not a big community. Essenes were very small in comparison to the Jewish community at the time, but they were Jewish. They were not, they were very much, in fact, they were trying to practice the essence of Judaism at the time in their small communities around the Dead Sea. I don't know if the language was, particularly removed from the people. It's a worthy topic, though.
Right. Well, in Light Upon Light, you say that with a touch of his hand or a glance, a master could awaken the spirit within. And nowadays, of course, everyone's aware of spontaneous remissions with so-called mm-hmm. diseased people. And some do have what could be called instantaneous enlightenment. And I'm wondering what you think about the workings of that. Do you think some people are destined and others aren't? Do you think some people who try their darndest their entire lives to meditate and go within, but it's just not going to happen for them and it will for others? Or what's your hit on that?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the fact that we all have dry spells, dark spells, if you will, on the spiritual path. But there are two reactions to those dark spells or dry spells. One reaction is to work even harder to move through the darkness, and the other reaction is to give up. And I believe that if you give up, then you never know what treasures were awaiting for you. And I believe that everybody goes through dark spells. Everybody goes through difficult moments. Using the St. John of the Cross, he called it the dark night of the soul, but that's part of the spiritual path, and we should embrace it. And we should embrace it in a positive sense of it, in meaning that the struggle that we go through actually builds the spiritual muscle, builds the spiritual fiber of our lives so that we can be even more compassionate, even more loving, and stronger, more resolute in our faith and our understanding of spirituality. So we have to make sure that we don't allow the darkness to overwhelm us and never fall into despair or disillusionment or disappointment, but just to keep struggling through that. And I believe everyone, if they keep struggling, will go through that. To address another part of your question, though, everyone comes with their own spiritual background. That, some people come having worked on this for many lifetimes and really, this has been their raison d'etre. And others are just coming to it because each of us is on our own evolutionary curve. And so those who come with a lot of background, it looks like it's easy for them, but in fact, they've been doing it for longer, that's all. And then others seem to struggle with it. It's because they're new to it. They're starting out on their evolutionary journey. They're not quite in the same place. But the important thing is not to compare yourself with others, all right? Wherever you are, that's where you are, and you work from where you are. The same principles apply. So I have seen people who, just make remarkable spiritual progress, and it's clear that from my perspective, my limited perspective, that they have worked on this for many lifetimes and that they're just picking up where they left off. In fact, in spirituality, there's a saying that whatever you accomplish spiritually, you never lose. it will always come back to you so long as you're headed in the right direction. You pick up where you left off in the next lifetime. Whereas intellectual progress, anything that we do in the world, actually we have to redo in a way.
Well, that's not such a bad thing.
Yeah.
There's always new information for the intellect.
Yeah, that's right. So.
Andrew, in recognition of having a good teacher, I'd like you to share your story about how you came upon your teacher and who that teacher is.
Yeah, I was initiated by Sant Kripal Singh, called the Sant Ma Tradition, which the book talks quite a bit about. It's a universal tradition. It's not a religion. It's a spiritual tradition. And I was in a phase of seeking when I was in my late teens, early 20s. And what happened was that I had I was actually going from one spiritual group to another, looking for the truth of that and trying to find what resonated with me, what worked for me. And one day I came upon a picture in a bookstore of my spiritual teacher, who I didn't know was my spiritual teacher at the time. I just resonated with the picture. It was a beautiful picture, which actually appears in the book. And it was such a powerful picture, and it resonated so deeply with me. It was almost like I had seen this face before I was born. And I just picked the picture up and started reading this pamphlet, and everything just seemed to make great sense. Shortly after that, I saw the same picture in a bookstore, and they were having, whoever was in the area was sponsoring a little talk about these particular teachings, and I went to it, and everything kind of clicked intellectually, and the interesting thing was that there was only one person who came to the talk, and I was the person. So when things are meant to happen, they're meant to happen.
Right.
And
very
I
good.
Spent about 5 hours asking questions and was totally amazed and by it. It seemed to resonate on all levels, particularly the universality of it, the practicality of it, and the initial experience. But then shortly after that, which really, the whole thing that really sealed it for me, was I had a deep and very powerful experience. When I got up one morning and started to meditate in my room, I was still a student at the time at Tulane University, and I was taken up into these spiritual dimensions where I saw just such brilliance of illuminations and such incredible, powerful, and beautiful spiritual universes and a music of the spheres, sounds that were just so intoxicating. I immediately made the connection with the teachings and with that, and it turned out later, when I finally did meet my spiritual master, that was a confirmation that was given to me out of grace. We don't earn anything. We certainly don't deserve any of that.
Right.
To let me know that I was moving in the right direction. That this was indeed the direction that I was supposed to move in. So those things I call the initiation moments. Those are the moments of transfiguration where you are given a connection with something much higher. You can't earn this. It's just grace. And it hopefully points you in the direction of your further search. The important thing I want to say for people who are seeking is that the teachings were congruent with the being of the teacher. And that's very important, that the teacher model and is a for each of us, the essence of the teachings. They have to be that model for us. They have to walk the talk themselves.
Andrew Vidic. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.